From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the new spy masters as we talk about espionage. Here's what's happening. Iran and the United States and its negotiating partners have finally reached an agreement on a deal that could curb Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. Now, this sets up a looming showdown between President Obama and Congress, where the lawmakers could take issue with several provisions, including one giving Iran leverage over inspections. And Israeli leaders across the political spectrum condemn this apocalyptic language that the PAC announced by the United States and world powers has, calling it an historic mistake that frees Iran to sponsor global terror while assembling the information and materials to build a weapon. Let's check in with Howard Bloom, author of The Genius of the Beast. Howard, have we forgotten all about Israel here?
We've put Israel on the sacrificial altar, and we've got the knife at its throat. This is very similar to a deal that the Clinton administration, which I supported, worked out in 1994 with the North Koreans. And by the way, it's centrist Knesset member from Israel, Michael Oren, who points this out. That 1994 deal was supposed to absolutely freeze all nuclear weapon development in North Korea through a rigid, strenuous program of inspections. Since then, North Korea has exploded three nuclear weapons, and it's building missiles that are designed to carry nuclear warheads to cities like Seattle and L.A. in the United States. It has the materials to build six nuclear weapons. So these systems of strenuous inspection do not necessarily work. And in this case, you just pointed out that the language is real weird when it comes to inspections. On the one hand, President Obama is telling us that this is a 24/7 inspection regime. We can go any place we want at any time. That is a lie. I hate to say that about something that a president has said, especially a Democratic president, because I'm a Democrat. But the fact is that the inspection regime has to submit a request to go someplace where it suspects something is happening to the Iranians. The Iranians have 3 weeks to sit on it. Then they can refuse the request, and they can propose some other way to get at the problem. This is this is a deal that is not what it's advertised to be, and that's why, again, Michael Oren, the Knesset member, says that, quote, for the first time in living memory, virtually all Israelis, left, right, religious, secular, Arabs, Jews, are together calling the deal disastrous. Says one more tiny thing. With two nuclear weapons, you can wipe out all of Israel. You wipe out Tel Aviv, you wipe out Haifa, Israel is gone. And a person who knows that better than anybody else is former Iranian president Hashem Rafsanjani, who basically said that we could wipe out Israel with one nuclear weapon. If they threw nuclear weapons at us, we're a big world. Frankly, the Islamic world is seven times the size of the United States. And he basically said it would only be a scratch on the surface of the Islamic world. Now, he said that in 2001. So you would think that by today, 14 years later, he would have calmed down, he would have become more moderate. But no, last week, when there was an entire celebration called Quds Day on Friday, celebrating the destruction of Israel, attended by the president of Iran, Rafsanjani said again, Israel will be wiped off the face of the map.
I know, this doesn't make any sense. Just keep an eye on Netanyahu, Howard. He's not going to sit back and watch this happen. Meanwhile, they're saying because of all this, U.S. drivers can look forward to $2 of gas later this year, thanks, they say, in part, to this deal. Gas may only dip a few cents when the Iranian oil starts to flow again, but by September, drivers could see big savings. We shall see. Medical examiners found no evidence to prove the allegation that blues legend B.B. King was poisoned before he died of natural causes in May. Tests conducted after two of the musical icon's 11 adult children said their father had been murdered showed the cause of death was Alzheimer's disease plus physical conditions, including coronary disease, heart failure, and the effects of type 2 diabetes. Facebook and Twitter are increasingly being used as sources of news, according to a new report from the Pew Research Center. The research found that 63% of the Twitter and Facebook users now use the social media sites as news sources, up from around 50% just a few years ago. This is an amazing way of changing the way that news is given and received, folks. It's going to change, I think, the planet. Probably already has. Some herbal food supplements do not contain what they claim to be label problems, according to a study. The BBC Health series, Trust Me, I'm a Doctor, teamed up with experts from the University College in London to test a number of products, and they simply say, for example, 30 ginkgo products tested, 8 contained little or no ginkgo extract at all. The landmark figure has been reached as the goal to get HIV treatment to 15 million people by the end of this year has already been met by the United Nations AIDS Agency. 9 months ahead of schedule, they are delighted with that. At a hearing in Manhattan, which he ruled filmmaker Denise D'Souza, a Coast to Coast guest, must continue community service for 4 more years, a U.S. district judge said he considers D'Souza's violation of federal campaign finance laws to be evidence of a psychological problem and ordered further counseling for him. Jerome Corsi wrote the article for WND. Jerry, this is a strange story. What's going on here?
It was very strange. I attended the hearing in downtown Manhattan in Judge Berman's court. And Judge Berman either was expressing a political view that conservatives must be psychologically deranged, or he said he was a social worker with a psych major. I think he was practicing a little psychology psychiatry from the bench. But Dinesh D'Souza has had very qualified examinations. Dinesh sent me today one of the evaluations done by Roger Gould, M.D., who is a psychiatrist, very distinguished psychiatrist, 25 years of publications, practicing in New York and California. And Dr. Gould, as opposed to the court, said, I see no evidence of psychopathology and certainly no evidence for any kind of psychotropic medication with Dinesh D'Souza. He does not have the symptoms of anxiety or depression. He is not an angry person with an impulse disorder. I do not believe that Dinesh D'Souza is hiding anything. He is what he presents himself to be. He's a man who made a mistake for good motives that led to bad judgment. He is very ambitious and dedicated to his work, which consumes most of his mental energies. He had very little time to give his old friend Wendy Long and gave too much money as a campaign contribution instead. Dinesh D'Souza is paying for that mistake and has accepted the penalty without rancor or resentment. Now, that's the conclusion of a professional psychiatrist, and Judge Berman did not want to hear that presented by Dinesh D'Souza's lawyer yesterday, Benjamin Braffman, in court. And I was quite astonished, George, to hear the judge impose additional, fishing expedition. Let's go get another psychiatrist until we can find
the one who put him away.
As a psychological disorder, then the judge may be satisfied. And we've got a Democratic judge here making these determinations without the authority to practice psychiatry or psychology from the bench. It was a very startling hearing, and quite frankly, George, very disturbing.
Strange things happening on this planet, Jerry. Thank you so much. Jerry writes for WND.com. Now, as we were reporting all night long, the New Horizons spacecraft made its historic Pluto flyby. All went well. As a matter of fact, go to coasttocoastam.com, take a look at some more pictures. This entire project, from the beginning to where it is right now, cost $720 million. Now, was it all worth it? First of all, let's check in with our science advisor, Robert Zimmerman, of course. Robert, first of all, the flyby, all went well, right? No problems? Everything good?
Yes, everything went well today, George. They, it was a blackout. They had no idea how it had gone yesterday at all. They wanted to let the spacecraft spend the entire day taking pictures. This is a one-shot opportunity, so they did not want to waste any time turning its antenna back to the Earth to send any images. So the entire day it was taking pictures, which means we can't find out what's happening. And then when it finally turns its antenna to us to send back images, or at least its status, it's going to take 4.5 hours for the signal to get here. So people were on pins and needles all day. The science team was releasing the last few images throughout the day that they had gotten before the blackout, showing some really nice stuff. I've got it posted on Behind the Black, my website. They had a really good false color image they released, which shows that the features are – this is very complex geology on both Charon and Pluto. And then at 9 o'clock, like 8:50, they start to listen, hoping. And they had a window of about 10 minutes. But within, like, seconds of that window opening, they started to get telemetry. And they said, and this is a quote, "We are in lock with telemetry with the spacecraft." And the whole place burst out into cheering. And, you know, now they're going to have to wait. Now the pictures are coming in and the data's coming in. It'll come in slowly. It's far away, and they only have so much bandwidth to transmit the images. We'll actually be waiting a year for all of it to get here. Tomorrow afternoon, they'll have a press release where they will release the first close-up images of the flyby. Stay tuned. It will be quite amazing to see those images.
Robert, it's all dramatic, but again, it cost $720 million for this flyby. Was it worth it, in your opinion?
Yeah, without question. The one of NASA's really successful programs is its planetary program. They have a lot of fat. We'll talk about this over the, you know, in the future, but there's a lot of waste at NASA, and there's a lot of things they could do better at NASA. But its planetary program, we get really good bang for our buck. It's not even $1 billion for the mission, $750 million. It sounds like a lot, but think about it a minute. The James Webb Telescope was budgeted for $1 billion and was supposed to launch in 2011. Its budget is now over $8 billion, and it won't launch until 2018, if then. So there's a lot of projects that cost a lot of money. This is cheaper than the Hubble Space Telescope also. No, it was absolutely worth it. It makes the United States special in one way. We're the only country that has sent a probe to every planet in the solar system. And we were the ones that got the images back first from most of the world, the solar system planet. We should be proud of that.
The technology is amazing. Robert's website, behindtheblack.com. Thank you, Robert. Rambo, the movies, of course, have previously taken him to Vietnam, Thailand, Afghanistan, Burma. But in Last Blood, he is reportedly set up to head to Syria, where he will apparently face his toughest enemies yet, ISIS. A representative for Stallone has denied this story so far, but we shall see. This week, warnings of an impending mini ice age set to hit in the 2030s have been circulating. It's a story that has caused shivers among the public, but there's one problem. Some climate scientists aren't buying it, but what is going on with the planet? Up next, Don Easterbrook joins me. Evidence-based climate science next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Don Easterbrook with us. His book, Evidence-Based Climate Science. Don is a professor emeritus of geology at Western Washington University. He's authored 10 books, 150 journal publications, that's a lot, and presented 31 research papers at international meetings in 13 countries. His current research activities include the cause of global climate change, global warming and cooling, and what it will do to all of us. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Don, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
So this story that's going around all over the place this week about a mini ice age, I do have a guest who claims we are in one now. His name's Robert Felix. He was an architect by trade, but he wrote a book called Not by Fire, But by Ice, and he claims we are in the beginning stages of a mini ice age. What do you think of this talk about that?
I think it's probably correct. We've never really left what's been known as a little ice age, which was a global cooling that took place beginning about 1300 AD and had a series of fluctuating climates from cold to warm, but included about a half a dozen cool periods during which alpine glaciers around the world advanced and caused all kinds of difficulty and caused major problems with food production, and it really interrupted civilization in various parts of the world. And so there are many people, including me, who think that we've never actually left the Little Ice Age. And therefore, this is not a surprise, and it's based primarily on the idea that the sun is now approaching what's called a solar minimum. And what that means is that the sun is not constant. It does all kinds of weird things, and it's doing really weird things right now. And among the things that it's doing is going into a mode which is very similar to some of these half a dozen little ice age episodes that have occurred since about 1300. So I think it's probably right.
If the temperature on the sun, Don, changes just by a little bit, it still would have dramatic effect on us, would it not?
That's right, but it's not just a matter of temperature. One of the major concerns is that the sun's magnetic field changes during these periods of solar minima. And that causes all kinds of problems with the climate on the Earth, because when the sun's magnetic field gets very low, then we no longer have its magnetic field as a shield for cosmic radiation that comes into the atmosphere. And this has a big effect on cloud production, which has a big effect on the amount of radiation, warmth if you like, that is reflected from the Earth's atmosphere. So it's not just a matter of the sun getting hotter and colder, because that doesn't change a lot, but there are major changes that occur in the magnetic field, and that affects the shielding of the Earth from radiation, and that has a major climate effect. You can correlate these changes one-to-one with cold climate for these half a dozen periods of cooling.
Don, I'm in St. Louis right now. I head back to L.A. next week, but in the short time I've been here, I've seen the temperatures at around 70, 75. It's been gorgeous to where in 1 week it's now close to 100. How in the heck do the temperatures change that fast?
It's called weather, and it happens all the time. Climate is not constant, and weather is a day-to-day thing that can bring you anything at any place. You can be in the middle of a cold period and have a really hot period, and you can be in just the opposite. So what's happening now is primarily an effect of a kink in the jet stream, and the climate is into a cooling phase. Actually, we've been cooling for the past decade. There's been no global warming for the past 18 and a half years, as confirmed by satellite measurements.
Let's talk about your work, evidence-based climate science, and some of your research, of course, is bound to get some people going crazy who do not believe in the kind of climate change that you're adjusting to and that we have believed, that we're in a cycle where the planet is changing, the solar system is changing, the sun is changing. But tell us about the basis of your work, your research.
The basis of my research is that in the oceans, there are changes that occur that have major effects on climate. And these effects leave a footprint, which you can read in the geologic record. So what I have done is to look at the patterns of changes in the oceans that have been associated with strong climate change, warming and cooling, if you like. And what I found was that there was a regular pattern with about a 60-year cycle that repeats over and over. We've had a number of these in the past century. We've had several periods of warming and cooling, and these have been accompanied by, or caused by, I should say, the changes in the ocean. A particular phenomenon known as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is a repeating pattern that reoccurs with a 60-year cycle. Warm, cold, warm, cold, warm, cold. And we can read it in the climate record, and we can read it in the ocean record. And so then I went to the Greenland ice cores, which are a treasure trove of data, because there are isotope measurements that allow us to look at the temperature going back thousands of years. So I went back 500 years and plotted the changes in the temperature that are recorded by these isotopes, and it turns out that this repeating pattern goes back about 600 years.
Jeez.
And so all you have to do then is say, well, if that pattern keeps doing what it's been doing for the last 500 years, where will we be in the next 60 years? And the answer is cool. So in 1999...
Hold on right there, Don. Hold on for a second. We'll take this quick break, and we'll come right back as we talk about evidence-based climate science. Amazing work. We'll be back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Don Easterbrook with us, his work, evidence-based climate science. Don, we were talking about the basis of your research, and how long did it take you to accumulate when you realized, for example, in those core samples, the timing of 500, 600-year cycles?
Well, it was actually rather sudden. I was working late at night, I don't know, 2 or 3 in the morning, and I was looking at some data from the oceans, and I noticed that there was a pattern that was strikingly similar to the climatic pattern that you see all over the world, both in temperature measurements and in glaciers going back and forth that is advancing and retreating. And it suddenly hit me, aha, there is a one-to-one correlation between what's going on in the ocean cycles and in the global climate cycles. And so I plotted this stuff up, and sure enough, it was a one-to-one fit. And this was in 1999, the year after one of the biggest temperature spikes because of El Nino. And so I predicted that we would be experiencing a 30-year period of global cooling, and everybody thought I was crazy. Well, we've now had 15 years since I made that prediction, and so we can test it and see how correct that that theory might be. And it turns out that the Antarctic ice now is growing, not melting. The UN Climate Commission had predicted there was going to be a 1 degree increase in temperature every 10 years. So by now, according to their models, we should be 1 degree warmer. Well, we're not. We're actually colder. We've had cooling going on, global cooling, for the past decade, past 10 years. The Arctic sea ice is actually growing, both in terms of the total area. And so it's essentially the same as it was in 1979. So the proof of the pudding is in the eating. You know, time will tell whether I'm right or not. And the
and you're not alone, Don.
So far is that for the first 10 years, it seems that the UN Commission has been woefully wrong. And so far, my prediction is holding up. So the basic idea is that the past is the key to the future. If we can discern a pattern and extend it in the future, we have some chance of figuring out where we're headed.
Don, with the climatologists, meteorologists, scientists, all looking at basically the same data, how does 50% of the group get it wrong and 50% of the other side of it get it right? I mean, why can't they come to some uniform agreement here about what's going on?
Well, there's a lot going on, and it's mostly political. The global warming scare, so on, is really not soundly based in science. It's based in politics. And there's a fundamental difference between the scientific approach and a dogmatic approach. And so what you're seeing in the press and in the politics and the government is a dogma approach with all these pronouncements that everything is solved. There's no need to question anything. And so what we're seeing now is politics, in some cases, at least in terms of the publicity it gets, politics is trumping true science. That's the problem.
With the temperatures, we are having hot times, we're having colder times. What are we having generally in summers and in winters? Hotter summers, colder winters? Is that what is happening?
No, not really. As I mentioned earlier, there has been no global warming in 18 and a half years, zero. We're the same now as we were 18 and a half years ago. So any teenager has never experienced global warming. So looking at the overall temperature record over that period, what we see is a slow cooling over the past decade. And the cooling has made itself felt in a number of ways. For example, I'm looking now at a map of the winter temperatures for 2001-2010. And the winters in the Great Lakes area are 8.7 degrees cooler. And in the Montana to Dakotas area, it's 8 degrees colder in the winter than the average had been. And the same is true all over the central U.S., a little bit different on the coast, where it's 2 degrees cooler. But the basic pattern is that general cooling, colder winters, especially in the east, and what we can look forward to probably is more of the same, especially if the sun continues in the pattern that it now seems to be headed.
We seem to be having extreme weather on both sides. What's causing that?
I'm chuckling because weather is not climate. Weather is a sort of a day-to-day fluctuation of what's going on in the atmosphere.
Right. That's an important point to make.
It's a huge important point to make because weather is not the same as climate. And you can't say, gee, we had the biggest storm we've ever had. That must mean that it's warming or it's cooling or anything else. And the truth of the matter is that I'm looking at now a variety of charts on tornadoes, snow cover, hurricanes, droughts, that sort of thing. And none of them are any more common now than they have been over the past 100 years. And in many cases, they are decreasing. For example, when was the last time a hurricane came ashore in the U.S.? You know, it's been a decade or more. And the same is true with tornadoes. We have fewer tornadoes than we used to have. We have more snow cover in 5 of the 6 snowiest years the Northern Hemisphere have been in the past 6 years. We have fewer hurricanes, and there's nothing unusual going on with drought. So extreme weather events are short-term atmospheric changes that can occur anytime. Doesn't matter whether it's a warm climate or a cold climate.
Right.
And you have to have an accumulation of something like 15 years of weather in order to be able to breed some kind of climatic trend out of it. Day-to-day stuff is just weather, and all this stuff about every time there's a big storm is caused by global warming is just total nonsense.
Now, this talk about rising sea levels, where is that coming from?
Again, I'm chuckling. There was a huge piece in the National Geographic not too long ago in which they were predicting that there was going to be a 20-foot rise of sea level, and they made a whole series of maps showing which areas were going to be underwater. We were going to lose most of Florida, and much of Europe was going to be inundated. So there was a big hue and cry. The truth of the matter is that we have sea level records that go back to the 1800s, and beginning about roughly 1850, sea level began to rise at a rate of about 7 inches a year. And it's been pretty much constant ever since then, regardless of what the climate was doing. So the idea that we're going to be having 20-foot sea level changes is just not credible. And there are several reasons for that. For example, I was just reading today about a person who was predicting that we were going to have a 20-foot sea level rise by the end of this century. Well, what you have to realize is that at the end of the last ice age, there were huge continental glaciers, 10,000 feet thick, over most of the northern landmass
right.
in the northern hemisphere. And at about 15,000 years ago, there was an incredibly rapid warming of about up to 24 degrees in a century. What we've experienced so far in this century is about 1 degree. So there were several periods of 20-degree warming in a century with these huge ice caps, and the rate of sea level rise of melting of all of these huge glaciers was about 3 feet a century. And they're predicting 20 feet a century. So the question is, where are they going to get the water? We didn't even have that kind of sea level rise when we had these immense ice sheets melting catastrophically, and we got nowhere near that. And when you couple that with the fact that the Antarctic ice is not melting, it's actually growing. And the same is true of Antarctic sea ice. Arctic sea ice is also increasing in the past decade. And so the answer to that question is, unless you can somehow conjure up a huge mass of water somewhere, there's no water to make anywhere near that kind of sea level rise. And so if you project the sea level fairly constant rise back for 150 years, you can expect about 7 inches in the next century, or in a lifetime, say in 50 years, you can expect to see about a 3 to 4 inch rise of sea level, and you'll never know what's happening.
That's a good point. And let me ask you about weather here. In the Midwest, we've had more rain than we need right now. Yet in Southern California, they've got a horrible drought that's been going on for years, and it's getting worse. Why are areas like that and like the Midwest so different, where we get too much rain, they don't get enough?
The answer, again, lies in the oceans. Just off the coast of North America, there is a water mass that has warmed and has caused a kink in the jet stream. The jet stream is the controller of the path of storms and of air masses. And so this kink in the jet stream goes north up into Alaska, which is why Alaska is so warm. It's pulling warm air up from the south. And then it dives down across roughly across the Rocky Mountains and across the central U.S. and then back out over the Atlantic. And so what this does is it brings the cold Arctic air down into the eastern half of North America and has given us two bitterly cold winters in the east and in the central U.S. And in the meantime, the West Coast has had a fairly balmy weather. Alaska, the western U.S., is on the warm side of the jet stream, and the rest of the country is on the cold side of the jet stream. And so that's why we're experiencing what we've had, and that's why it's dry in California. There is now an El Nino, which is an ocean current phenomena at the equator, which generally causes rain in California. And so the prediction is that California's drought may be coming to an end in about a year or so.
Let's hope so. Let's keep our fingers crossed. Well, with Don Easterbrook, his book, Evidence-Based Climate Science, the subtitle of the book is really interesting, too. Data opposing CO2 emissions as the primary source of global warming. Tell me about that.
Well, the whole idea behind global warming was that atmospheric emissions by human beings has caused the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and has caused, as the greenhouse gas, warming of the atmosphere due to the absorption by CO2. But what you have to realize is that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is very, very small. And so the bottom line here is that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere constitutes a very, very small percentage of the atmosphere, and it's not enough really to have any real effect. And the amount of CO2 is 41 thousandths of 1%, which is pretty close to nothing. And CO2 is a greenhouse gas, accounts for only about 3.5% of the greenhouse effect. 95% is nothing but water vapor. And so a greenhouse gas that makes up 41 thousandths of 1% and contributes only 3% to the greenhouse effect has increased only 3 one-thousandths of 1% during the global warming period, and that isn't enough to cause more than about a tenth of a degree temperature change. So we can check this by looking at the past record of when we've had an increase in CO2, has the temperature increased? Well, the answer is no. There's no correlation at all. I think it's an anti-correlation between CO2 and global temperature. For example, the emissions started soaring after World War II in 1945. And you think if CO2 causes warming, it should have been a warm period. But we had 30 years of global cooling while the CO2 was absolutely soaring. And we've had now some oscillations back and forth. But CO2 has continued to rise at a very steady rate over the past 20 years, and yet we've had zero global warming. And so all of these things add up. And we can also look at the geologic record, where in the past, where there's been an increase in CO2, it always follows an increase in global temperatures. We know this from the isotope record in the ice sheets and also from shorter-term measurements. And so if CO2 was causing warming, it would have to precede the warming. But it doesn't. It always follows the warming. And the answer to that is that the warming causes release of CO2 from the oceans into the atmosphere. And so that's why CO2 always lags global warming. So Don, CO2 is not the cause of major climate change.
Well, and, you know, during the dinosaur era, did we not have higher CO2 levels than we even have now?
Oh, many times. For the past 50, 60 million years or so, we've had CO2 levels that are roughly five times as high as they are now. People have been saying, oh, if the amount of CO2 gets above 400, we're all going to perish. Well, instead of having only, as we have now, 41 thousandths of 1%, we had about 0.02%. In other words, five times as much CO2, and life on Earth thrived. So the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere over the past 50 million years has generally been much, much larger than it is now with no ill effects.
Just amazing work, Don. And how many people have confused climate change with the push? You know, nobody wants to pollute the planet, but I have a feeling people are confusing pollution with climate change, don't you?
Well, what you'll see as sort of the poster child of the CO2 push for the cause of climate change is a smokestack with a bunch of stuff coming out of it. And the impression you get is that, oh, this is just pumping CO2 in the atmosphere like crazy. Well, most of what you're seeing, of course, is nothing but water vapor. And so there are all kinds of little propaganda-like tricks that are going on in the news media. And there is a real concern about pollution of things that are toxic. But CO2 is not toxic, despite the fact that the Supreme Court decided that CO2 was a toxic gas. It's not. It's necessary for life. And in fact, we're now approaching all-time lows for CO2 in the atmosphere. And during the last ice age, we came dangerously close to having a CO2 level that was so low that vegetation would have died. And that would have caused, of course, a huge...
That would have been a bigger problem.
Depends on it.
Yep, a bigger problem. But again, back to pollution. I mean, I applaud people for cleaning up the air, cleaning up the environment, cleaning up our land. I mean, nobody wants that kind of pollution, but everybody seems to be confused between, again, climate change caused by man, climate change caused by what nature's doing in a cyclical basis on this planet. And I've always been a believer, Don, that, you know, it's the planet. The planet goes through these cycles. It's not mankind that's doing this.
That's right. The effect of mankind on climate is kind of like a flea on an elephant's back. And man is not directing climate any more than a flea can direct an elephant, because the amount of energy and the forces involved are way, way beyond what 0.03% of a change in a trace gas can possibly cause. But the putting of pollutants, real pollutants in the atmosphere, things that will harm you, there are all kinds of toxins that are being emitted from various places, and those really need cleaning up.
Absolutely.
Because they're causing damage, and they're causing health problems and all sorts of things that are not good. So I'm a strong advocate for cleaning up the atmosphere. But to try to stop CO2 is totally absurd.
All right, Don, we're going to come back in a moment. In our final hour, we'll take some phone calls with you as we continue talking about your work, evidence-based climate science. It's just refreshing to hear someone like you with your credentials talking the way you are. So let's take some calls when we come back right here on Coast to Coast AM.